You are perhaps most famous to the general public as the author of The People's History of the United States, which was published in 1980, and which is a form of history from below.
Mm.
I wanted to ask you if you were influenced, or what your assessment is of another academic and activist, E.P. Thompson, who wrote The Making of the English Working Class, which was published in 1963, another form of history from below.
Yeah, well, I was, of course, aware of E.P. Thompson. E.P. Thompson was to me an important figure, and sure, an example of how you dig beneath the official history and look at what working class people are doing. So, yes, I mean, it's not that that precipitated me, but it was in my consciousness, and I had read it and admired it, and, you know, I was probably influenced not by any academic work, not by any piece of writing. I was really influenced by my experience in the South, especially, and then my experience in the anti-war movement, both experiences having persuaded me that the histories of our country were inadequate, that they left out the people who made history, the working people, the black people, Native Americans, women. I mean, for instance, talking about the influence of my experience in the South and getting me to write the book, when I was in Selma, Alabama, I contacted Columbia University, where I had my PhD. I knew they had an oral history project. I also knew what the oral history project was. It wasn't a Studs Terkel project. It was a project where they interviewed famous people, ex-secretaries of state, ex-generals, etc., and recorded their interviews. But I wrote to them. I said, you know, you're an oral history project. There's real history going on down here. Really interesting people to talk to, not ex-generals, not ex-secretaries of state, just people involved in a very important and dramatic movement. So what we have to do is send somebody down here with a tape recorder. And I got a letter back from Columbia University. Well, very good idea. When somebody starts off with, that's a very good idea, you know they're not going to do anything. It's a very good idea. But we don't have the resources to do that. Columbia University doesn't have the resources. You know, it's like the United States government. It doesn't have the resources to build another school. You know, they don't have the resources. So anyway, I started taping. I was taping interviews with people in the movement, taping the evening in Selma, Alabama, and I think that helped sort of germinate the idea in me of history from below.
You are, of course, a playwright as well as a historian, and you've written a play about Marx in Soho. What's your relationship intellectually with Marx and Marxism?
Well, when I was, 17, 18, and maybe it was my communist friends in the neighborhood who were always giving out literature and who gave me a copy of the Communist Manifesto. When I read the Communist Manifesto, I thought, wow. That explains a lot. After all, the Communist Manifesto is, you know, it's not a scholarly complex thing. It's very relatively simple and clear, you know. Here it shows you the historical development of the human race from primitive communism through feudalism and capitalism and analyzes capitalism and shows you why capitalism fails and what's wrong with it and how it's a historical phenomenon. It's not a permanent fixture in our history. It came into being at a certain point. It'll leave at a certain point and be replaced by a different society, a socialist society. Anyway, it all made sense to me. You might say it made sense of my own life. And so I when I got together with my other three radical shipyard workers, we met once a week and read books. We read Marx and Engels. We read all sorts of things and discussed them. So, yeah, later on I read Volume 1 of Capital. Even tried to read Volume 2 and Volume 3. Ooh. Maybe that led me to the conclusion that better not write long and complex and difficult things. Write things that people can understand. And so in my play, for instance, I don't know if you know my play, but you know, there's a sort of exchange between Marx and his wife, Jenny, and she sort of shakes her head about das Kapital. No, she reads the first sentence of Das Kapital, which is so forbidding, you know. History of all societies, history of commodities and this and that. And she said, no, that won't do. You have to write like the Communist Manifesto. Anyway, I was very interested in Marxist theory. When I was teaching, political theory. I taught Marxism. Soon I was teaching a seminar in Marxism and anarchism and comparing their ideas. And so, yes, that interest in Marxism led me to write this play.
You also wrote a play about Emma Goldman, and I understand that you identify as an anarchist. At what point did anarchist ideas start influencing you?
Well, it's interesting that you say I identify as an anarchist. I don't think I've ever specifically identified myself as an anarchist. Maybe I don't specifically identify myself as anything because I'm cautious about labeling myself. And when people don't know what the label means, you know, and because the word anarchist suggests so many different things, so I don't want people to get the wrong impression. I don't want them to think I'm a bomb thrower. I'm a peaceful person. Probably of all the political philosophies that there are, probably anarchism comes closest to my way of thinking. And I think when I try to think of when did I become interested in it, even before I began specifically reading anarchist ideas, even before I read Emma Goldman's autobiography, I was already, for one thing, I was disaffected from the Soviet Union, from that idea of socialism, and therefore I was open to the idea that all governments are dangerous to human freedom, and that we need a society that's free of authority. But my specific introduction to anarchism came in the 60s, when actually I encountered a fellow historian named Richard Drennan, who had written a biography of Emma Goldman. I didn't know that, but you know, when two academics get together, they say, "Oh, what have you written?" <It's>, "Oh, I just wrote this biography of Emma Goldman." Oh. I actually had read a little about Emma Goldman. You know, vaguely I knew anarchist, you know. But I decided I would read his book, Rebel in Paradise. It's a wonderful book. And it excited me, Emma Goldman. Then I read on went on to read her autobiography, Living My Life, which is one of the great autobiographies, and which later I would always recommend to my students. And so I read Bakunin and Kropotkin, and I was more and more attracted to anarchism because it was anti-authoritarian. And there's a talking about labeling yourself and describing what you believe in. And as I say, I've always had trouble saying, oh, I'm a socialist, or I'm a Marxist, or I'm this or that. Well, I will say, oh, I believe in socialism so long as I can explain what I mean. I'm a Marxist so long as I can explain what I mean. But sometimes I will say, well, there's a three-word description of how I feel. I got this from Dalton Trumbo. Dalton Trumbo, the Hollywood writer who was blacklisted and wrote one of my favorite books, Johnny Got His Gun, a great anti-war novel. And Dalton Trumbo was once asked, well, are you a communist? Or what do you believe in? You know, how do you describe yourself? He said, well, what I believe in, he said, is socialism without jails. Three word. I thought, yeah, that's good. So I wrote a play about Emma Goldman, and the play was the longest running play in Boston in 1977. What was interesting to me is that, I mean, anarchism is presumably a political philosophy held by very few people. You know, anarchists are on the fringes of society, but if you present anarchist ideas, present them through a fascinating character like Emma Goldman, people are all for it. They're interested.
Do you think that a synthesis of Marxism and anarchism, of the red and the black, so to speak,
yes,
would be fruitful for the left now?
I think it would, yes. Yes, take the analysis of Marxism, of capitalism, and his call to action, his call for philosophers to change the world and not simply record it, and take the anarchist idea of being suspicious of authority and centralized power, I think that blending of Marxist and anarchist ideas is something that is a good ideal.
I've read that you see the Paris Commune, that experiment that happened, short-lived, but in 1871 in Paris, that you see it as perhaps a model for what a future society might look like. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the Paris Commune and why you view it that way.
Well, the Paris Commune was a situation in which, I guess, taking advantage of the fact that France and Germany were at war, and it was an opportunity for workers to seize the city of Paris and to take charge of the city and to set up a commune. They were called the Communards, and they created a cooperative egalitarian society in Paris where people traded things and people, there's no crime really. People had nothing to be to be criminal about. Decisions were made by clusters of people gathering in the streets and then passing on their ideas to the members of the sort of the leaders of the commune. But the leaders of the commune were people who didn't get a salary which was greater than an ordinary worker's salary. And they created schools for women. There was no such thing as education for women at that time. And they had free admission to the theater. They made things available to to everybody on an egalitarian basis, and they made decisions based on people getting together and talking and discussing, and it was an admirable society while it lasted, and then it was crushed. But there have been other instances like that in history, which are models in the sense that, well, they give us at least a glimpse of what is possible. You know, Barcelona in 1936, early months of the Spanish Civil War, as described by George Orwell in his book Homage to Catalonia. Again, people sharing things. No crime. What's interesting is in The Grapes of Wrath, which we were talking about before at the very end, Tom Joad, who certainly doesn't know anything about political theory, never read anything about any of these things, but he talks about how in the government camps that were set up to help migrant workers, that people helped one another. And he said, there are no cops keeping order. No. And we had a better order than any cop could bring us, you know. And so I think it's something that people, the kind of society people would welcome.
How do you think fundamental change can come about? Do you think that for a thoroughgoing transformation of society towards something like the Paris Commune or something else very different than what we have now, do you think that it would require some sort of thoroughgoing revolution, or do you subscribe more to the notion that gradual change can come from building a new society within the shell of the old?
No, I don't think a revolution in the old sense of seizing power of the capital. No, we've had enough experience with that to suggest that that's dangerous and corrupting. And yes, I think building institutions, it's a slower process. Building free institutions within the old society and so liberating the ground one by one, you know, liberating this institution and that institution, and, you know, workers taking over industries, students taking over and universities, people in neighborhoods taking over the running of the neighborhoods and the security of the neighborhood. I think it will come, not gradualism in the sense of, you know, waiting too long, but working to liberate society piece by piece from within.
Well, in your life, you've been very engaged with the question of organizing and how does one move forward, and you've argued that small moments can add up to the achieving of a great deal of social change. Now, reflecting with the really wide knowledge that you have of social movements over decades and your historical perspective on social movements over centuries, do you think that we can learn lessons now in the left or the radical left from the past in terms of organizing in a different way to engage people? I'm thinking, for example, about the anti-war movement, and you mentioned how people can get frustrated about the lack of effect. But you do have a situation where the society at large, or many people within the society at large, are against the current U.S. occupations, and yet transforming it into a movement that can bring an end to these occupations has been hard. So what lessons from the past do you think we should draw on now in thinking about organizing for the long term?
Yeah. See, I don't think it's a matter of finding some dramatically different techniques of organizing or protest, you know, because, you know, I think the idea of people resisting in various ways, people refusing, developing there are certain tactics which are the most effective in confronting power, based on the idea that the people in power hold their power only because they are obeyed. When people withdraw their obedience, when people withdraw their support from the institutions, people who control these institutions become powerless. Notice with a strike is a fundamental weapon, because no matter how powerful the corporation, if workers go on strike, the corporation is helpless. This is what happened in the 1930s. People thought, no, you can't fight General Motors or Ford. Look at, they're rich, they're big. And, oh, workers leave the factory and they can't function. They are helpless. When, same thing with consumers. When consumers boycott, this is a not sufficiently used weapon. It was used by Chavez on the West Coast and the farm workers, the boycott of grapes, and it brought farm growers, these very wealthy, powerful farm growers, to have to recognize the Farm Workers Union. When Jesse Jackson threatened to call a boycott of Texaco because they had been guilty of racist practices, Texaco immediately caved in. They were worried. You know, in other words, this is what they depend on. They depend on people to buy their products. You stop buying their products, they are scared. And then, of course, when soldiers refuse to fight, which is what happened in the Vietnam War, they couldn't count on the military anymore. You know, that's an aspect of the anti-war movement that has been underplayed. But the fact is that the GI resistance in the Vietnam War was crucial in making the U.S. government decide it could not carry on the war. So what I'm saying is we have to think about tactics that can overcome power. Have to think about what it is that holds these people in power, these institutions in power. And so developing these strike, the boycott, the refusal of soldiers in the military, and the building of institutions, the building of cooperative institutions, yes, the building of cooperatives, all kinds of cooperatives, farmers' cooperatives, consumers' cooperatives, housing cooperatives, all of that, you know. And, yeah, it's a long process, but I think it can be done.
Do you think we should also evaluate and think about new ways of reaching people? You have yourself, well, obviously been deeply engaged in teaching and combining teaching and activism. Mm. But also I understand that you studied the use of documentary film in educating people. Do you think that perhaps the arts might be a more effective way of bringing people who are from outside of the immediate left in, and is that why you write your plays?
I think the arts are enormously important, because the arts, what the arts do is they bring passion, emotion to ideas. And so the ideas are simply not dry, prosaic statements, but the ideas come alive on the stage or in music. And when I heard Paul Robeson sing, when I was a teenager, wow. Pete Seeger, and then in the 60s, Dylan and Joan Baez, and music, theater, movies. Art has a very special and powerful role to play, because it enhances people's feelings and it gives strength to people's ideas and inspires people. So, I think that's one way in which people will be moved, and we have to consciously think about that in the future. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you. Good questions.
And that was a conversation I had with historian Howard Zinn in Auburndale, Massachusetts, 2 months before he died. I'm Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org.